Little Novels by Wilkie Collins, a series of five short stories dramatized by John Arden, with Ronald Pickup as Wilkie Collins. Number 5. Miss Morris and the Stranger.
William, William, Henry 1, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John, Henry, Edward.
These days this house is almost full of children, hard at work under their governess. Succession of the Kings of England, that's what that is. Like living in an aviary. Some of them my children, Martha being their mother. Some of them step-grandchildren by Catherine's daughter, Harriet. Oh, I still can't decide how on earth to write a will that will fairly apportion all my earnings amongst my two morganatic families. Such mixed-up relationships. I'm almost too old to keep count. Almost too old, certainly far too ill to bother to read any new books. No, I prefer to reread. Today, no doubt prompted by the proximity of the governess, Jane Eyre. Oh, so passionate. Published 40 years ago when I, Wilkie Collins, had written nothing but half an historical romance, which I had no aptitude nor any qualification save a family trip to Rome, where I lost my virginity at the age of 13. True, the Signora did say she was a noble woman, in secret, in such a city, where a self-styled princess, I could almost believe we were inhabiting, what, the 5th century. And that's why Jane Eyre was to open my eyes so widely. Its peremptory hero, straight out of the murk of history by way of Lord Byron, yet the girl who shall curb him is a brisk North Country governess you could meet tomorrow morning on Bradford Railway Station just like that. Ancient atrocity, modern respectability, vinegar and oil within the one sensational narrative. From it, I stole the formula for all my best work ever since. Today, I'm not too well. I have to keep going at something. I've done more than steal the formula, pretty well stolen the plot. An up-to-date Jane Eyre, a bourgeoisified Rochester, rub 'em together incongruous. Do they fire off any sparks?
When I first saw him, he was lost, in a little town beside the coast of Kent. They call it Sandwich. It was once a great seaport, then the harbour silted up, and now it is, what, one of the dead cities of England.
I say, I have lost myself.
People who don't know the town often do that.
Which is my way to the Fleur-de-Lis Inn?
The way you're going is the wrong way. Turn round, go back, turn to the left. Go on till you find two streets meeting. Take the street to the right and then... Complicated indeed. But I didn't stumble over a word. He should have understood. Follow the lane until you smell stables. And there you are. At once. At the back of the Fleur-de-Lis.
How the devil am I to remember all that?
Rude. But even the rudest may have redeeming qualities. I will show you the way to the inn, if that's what you like.
Yes.
When you were a boy, and you wanted something, did your mother never teach you to say please?
She did. And she taught me to say beg your pardon when I was rude. I'll say it now. Beg your pardon.
Thank you. If you'll walk with me.
This very ancient town of yours would seem to be decayed.
Thoroughly decayed.
You speak as though you were proud of that.
Because it is decayed, Sandwich is melancholy. Melancholy is inseparable from dignity and age. Logic. You see, I am a woman who is well capable of logic. Now, you smell stables? You can't mistake your way to the door of the Fleur-de-Lis.
Must we say goodbye?
Yes.
I have ordered lunch here. I am quite alone. We might invite the landlady to join us if you were afraid that perhaps...
Quite out of the question, sir. And you ought to know it.
Yes, of course. But perhaps you might just shake hands with me.
Oh, and I was fool enough to do it. And then lost all my dignity by running away. to the house where I worked as a governess. As I pulled at the doorbell, I thought, what an irregular conversation, so disruptive to the decorum of my employment. How was I to know that that very morning, my whole life would be disrupted forever?
I haven't yet made up a name for this consequential young person. Nancy Morris, aged 21, born in Sandwich, daughter of a struggling shopkeeper.
In Sandwich, all the shopkeepers struggle. My father died when I was 13. My mother tried to sell the business. Nobody would buy. She fell ill, was often bedridden, most of the time left me in charge. One day, I was alone in the shop, when in came an elderly gentleman.
Good morning. I wonder, do you have such an item as a needle pressure stylograph?
Needle what? No, I'm sorry, sir. We don't have one of those.
Are you sure? A patent automatic pen. It carries its own ink.
Oh, that! You mean a squirt pen. That's what we call it in the trade, you see.
Of course, the trade. Would you mind if I asked you how old you are?
So he asked me several further questions and then, well, he patted me on the cheek. He did not seem to think such behaviour in any way questionable.
14 years old. Well, well, well. The fact is, young lady, I've taken a fancy to you. Your competence as a shopkeeper at such an early age, your spirited demeanour, your the delightful look of you, only impaired, oh dear me, by your manifest ignorance and lack of education.
Oh dear me. And thereupon he offered, all in a flush and a fluster, first to me, then to my mother, to pay for me to go to a high-class ladies' boarding school. His name was Sir Jervis Damien. He'd excellent references to his character and status. The offer was tempting. My mother must consider it, but...
But my readers will be well aware that aged aristocrats and shopgirls are not, as a rule, the most reputable connection, as indeed Lady Damien maintained.
Sir Jervis had only just married her. She was much younger than he was. She was appalled to discover he was extending largesse to a chit. Oh, dear me. And then suddenly, my poor mother was dead. No decision had been made. I was alone in the world. Sir Jervis Damien's man of business came to Sandwich and inquired for me.
He announces with no sort of friendliness...
No sympathy at all for my bereavement.
He announces... Sir Jervis, however unwisely, gave you a promise. I am therefore instructed to take you to the boarding school he spoke of, and to make all arrangements for you to stay there until you're 18. No communication whatever with Sir Jervis, if you please, save through the hands of the rector of Sandwich.
I have always been proud. For the next 4 years, my pride alone was my support in a school where I made few friends and could foresee for myself no future except...
Except as a governess?
Except as a governess, which many would have scorned. I myself scorned to make application where it was clear I was no longer wanted, I mean to Sir Jervis. So all upon my own, I found myself a place in my own hometown, instructing the children of a kind-hearted merchant.
So, she's in Sandwich for the next 3 years, everything goes smoothly, until the story turns round on itself and brings us once again to the day of the...
To the day of the disruption. The peremptory stranger, the man who said so forcibly that Sandwich was decayed. He was right. Upon that same day, my employer discovered himself insolvent. What was I to do?
Stifle her pride and write to Sir Jervis?
Oh, no, no. Even though I'd heard his jealous wife was no longer alive. This old man, who adored young women, had so loved her, her death must have broken him. So instead, I had to advertise. Yes, in the public print. Sordid, but it worked. For at once I had the offer of a situation in the north of England, at a salary which would double my income. A Mrs. Fosdyke, of Carsham Hall.
I choose the north of England not because of Charlotte Bronte, but because it's a long way from Sandwich, and to get there she'd have to travel through London, where...
Where Sir Gervas had his townhouse. The rector of Sandwich had received a sudden letter, asking him to ask me to call upon Sir Gervas there, for a very sufficient reason.
My child, I am dying. I wanted to see you before I die. For I know you must have thought me neglectful and unkind. You have not been forgotten.
Sir Gervas, I owe everything. Everything, sir, to your fatherly kindness. I took hold of his one white hand and respectfully put it to my lips. He insisted he wished to do something more for me.
Some little service to remember me by. What shall it be?
Try to get better, sir, and let me write to you now and then. Indeed, I want nothing more. I thought of him all the journey to Carsham. When I got there, I had little chance to brood. A handsome old mansion, Mrs. Fosdyke, a handsome young widow, three children, and a regular series of house guests. In her large, lofty schoolroom full of sunlight, my new employer let me know all her views on education.
Poetry, committed to memory and recited, is a valuable means toward the production by children of a favourable impression on others, even in ordinary conversation. I therefore regard it as of the greatest importance to practice the children in the art of reading aloud.
We had a professor of elocution at school. I hope a good one.
I hope. Well, we shall see. I'll leave you to it.
Edward, 1, 2, 3. Richard, 2, upon his knee. To false usurp.
After a week,
Henry,
the children and I had begun to understand each other.
Stop. That's quite enough of all those wicked old kings. Freddy, you have learned a piece of poetry for me, yes?
Shakespeare, Miss Morris. Here. Under leave of Brutus and the rest. Miss Morris? Oh, yes. And the rest for Brutus is an honourable man, so are
stop,
they...
Stop! We seem to know the words, but we must learn to say them with correctness of expression. Like this, pay attention. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honourable man. Expression, do you see? Try if you can do the same.
Don't do anything of the kind, Freddy. It's all spoken wrong.
What? Who said that?
It's only Mr. Sachs in the garden below the balcony.
I shall be obliged to close the window if this is repeated.
I paused for an apology. Nothing.
Now, Freddy, the speech once again, just as I told it to you. Come. Here, under leave...
Gracious heavens, I cannot stand it.
Oh!
Why don't you speak it properly?
No, sir, no!
I forgot myself entirely, bounced out onto the balcony, and there...
Oh, good Lord! Sandwich!
Good Lord, he cried, and ran. Sandwich, good Lord, I thought. And then, like an idiot, I burst into peals of laughter, and likewise the children.
So his name was Mr. Sachs, and clearly he was a joke in the house, and they were only too anxious to explain to me why.
Do we know what is his Christian name, Freddy?
Sextus, Miss Morris. It's Latin for number 6. But all the other 5 are dead, Miss Morris. Brothers and sisters. He's all alone.
Which prompted me, of course, to ask, was he married? They said they didn't know. But they did know he was very poor.
And he doesn't care who knows it. But he doesn't wear rags and tatters, so perhaps...
At which point, into the schoolroom... Prudence, one of the maids, comes, bringing me a note. She informs me she's to wait for an answer. It said, I am so ashamed of myself.
Upon my honour, nobody told me when I got here yesterday that you were in the house. I thought it was a stage-struck housemaid, amusing herself with the children. May I accompany you when you go out for your walk with the children? One word will do, yes or no.
No. Will you tell him so, Prudence? Thank you. He had compared me to a stage-struck housemaid. And yet, I would have preferred to say yes. I lingered a little as we put on our shoes and coats in the hall, preparatory to the walk. One eye upon the children, one ear out to eavesdrop. For there were voices outside on the steps. Yes. His voice among them and...
Freddy, your shoelace.
Yes. They were talking about me.
No need to introduce me to the new governess. Miss Morris and I have met on a former occasion.
Oh, indeed, Mr. Sirks. Does that embarrass you? Or do you suggest it embarrasses her?
We produced, I'm afraid, a disagreeable impression, both ways. I beg none of you to speak of me to her. Neither you, Mrs. Fosdyke, nor Miss Melbury, you.
I say, Mr. Sirks.
Freddy, come back here.
Mr. Sirks, it's not true. Miss Morris doesn't mind you a bit. She only laughs at you. We all saw her.
Freddy, humiliating moment. Mrs. Fosdyke restored the situation, bustled the adults away, and joined herself at once to me and the children in our walk.
I'm surprised you should dislike Mr. Sachs.
Really, ma'am, we met by the merest accident. I know nothing about him.
And that's why you laugh at him?
Or do you tell me my son's telling lies?
Oh, no, of course not.
Whether or no about that, Mr. Sachs is a very odd man, and I really do think you and he should understand each other. I will see what can be done. In the meantime, there is a third person who is sadly disappointed to hear you know nothing about Mr. Sachs.
She meant, of course, Miss Melbury. Wealthy and beautiful and dark. At which point, Mrs. Fosdyke decided to sing rather than speak.
Oh, mon amante, oh, mon désir.
In French, which she knew I understood about love, which was quite off the point. So why was I so excessively angry? And with whom? Surely not with my well-intentioned employer, who suddenly astonished me with an entirely gratuitous invitation.
Miss Morris, this evening I have a dinner party, so make yourself beautiful and join us later in the drawing room.
Beautiful? Oh, indeed. In all my life, I never took such pains with my hair. Mr. Sachs was not quite sure whether to approach me or not.
Won't you shake hands?
Again? As at sandwich? Very well. We shook hands. He sat down in my modest corner on the very same sofa as myself. And then, with one remark, he went and spoiled everything.
What sort of sensation is it when you shake hands with a man whom you hate?
If that is what you think, sir, let me freely resign you to a lady with a far better claim. You are neglecting Miss Melbury most shamefully. She was glaring at us like a basilisk. And yet he made no move toward her until she rose from her chair, took a song from the music stand and...
Mr. Sachs, I'm going to sing. Please come to the piano and turn over for me.
Ah, yes. Most certainly, Miss Melbury.
I dreamt that I dwelt in marble halls with vassals and serfs at my side.
A dear old lady near me said Miss Melbury should be on the stage. I thought so too. So we talked about the stage, which meant I could take no more notice of Mr. Sachs. Until later, when the household was retiring for the night. He hovered about and offered me a bedroom candle. I handed it at once to Miss Melbury. Here you are, Miss Melbury. And if you want to travel to Babylon, let but your heels be nimble and bright. You may get there by candlelight.
I beg your pardon.
Oh, no, ma'am. I beg yours. Only a bit of a nursery rhyme. I did try to keep it in the schoolroom. It wouldn't stay. At breakfast next morning, most unexpected news. Mr. Sachs was no longer with us. He had left by the very first train, and none of them would admit they knew why. Nor did they know that I ran to my room and gave way most degradingly to floods of tears.
Throughout the next few dreary days, no words of significance from Mrs. Fosdyke, silent detestation from Miss Melbury, and then at last, an empty house. The guests all returned to their homes, Mrs. Fosdyke on a visit to Scotland, myself left alone with the children.
High time I brought her to the moral dilemma without which no story can properly conclude. She's alone. She gets a letter from Sir Gervas Damien's man of business. He writes to inform her, in the coldest possible terms, that Sir Gervas...
Sir Gervas... Oh, God! He was dead! And more than that, more, the letter said that...
It says that the will of Sir Gervas is not yet proved, but I can inform you confidentially that he has bequeathed to you absolutely the whole of his personal property, £70,000.
And then, after that, in most cunningly guarded language, it went on to imply that my influence upon Sir Gervas had been unutterably shameful. The writer made a point of pointing out...
He points out, and with glee, that there is a surviving close relative of the late Sir Gervas, whom the will does not even mention. In the event of this gentleman disputing the document, you will, of course, hear from me again.
I would never have taken money to which someone else held just claim. At least, I do not think so. But now I'd become subject to this vile accusation. How could I be sure what I would or would not have done? How could anyone be sure that at the age of 14, when I first met my benefactor, I had not allowed him to... No. Oh, no. No!
In vain she attempts to determine, is her feeling of ineradicable guilt due to the fact that she is in fact guilty? Or is it an hallucination not unlike one of my opium visions, brought upon her by this avalanche of enormous and unmerited wealth? Either way, her motives for whatever she shall do next are utterly crucial. Yet she gives herself no time to think. She splashes the ink everywhere. What is she writing? What?
Sir, I refuse to receive the bequest. Please arrange that the money be transferred to the surviving close relative. Even supposing that justice be done to my motives, I insist that no expression of thanks be addressed to me. I am doing no more than my duty. It was done. And I'd brought myself back from the brink. Oh, so they had to show me I was morally suspect. How sharply was I tempted to confirm the suspicion? Why, I'd all but accepted this poisonous legacy, not for the money, quite simply out of spite. Mrs. Fosdyke came home. I was still full of spite. Must have been, for she said,
"My dear Miss Morris, you don't look at all well. I believe I know why. You have had some little time to contemplate and repent your bad behaviour toward Mr. Sachs."
"Oh, Mrs. Fosdyke, please."
"Was he really to blame for not being rude enough to say no when a lady asked him to turn over her music? Why, the very next morning he fled from poor Miss Melbury right out of the house. You didn't know that was his reason. Ah, but did you deserve to know? Certainly not, after the vixenish manner you handed her the bedroom candle. All I can say is thank heaven Mr. Sachs is too poor to marry you and take you away from my children, at least for a good long time. Shall I write to him, do you think, and ask is he prepared to forgive you?"
"Oh, no! But, oh, yes. She was a matchmaker. In the upshot, a successful one, but so very, very nearly not. For next day, I had another letter about the will. It included the name of the surviving close relative, a Mr. Sextus Cyril Sachs. Oh, gracious God, I was buying myself a husband, just as I had previously been bought by a rich old man. Prostitute both ways. I was petrified with horror, sat upon the floor of that schoolroom like a corpse. Mrs. Fosdyke came and found me. Compelled me up into the open air. Compelled me to tell her about Sir Gervas, about the will, the accusation, everything. Don't you see? He does not know that I did not know it was going to turn out to be him.
And you think he won't believe you when you tell him. So why should not I tell him? Sit on a bench here and wait for me to find him.
Find him? Mrs. Fosdyke, where is he?
I imagine by now he will be strolling up from the railway station. He likes to take the shortcut through the wood. I will go and meet him and return to you at once. Sit.
No, she did not return. Instead, he came, alone, deadly pale, his eyes wild and startled, icy cold fingers. He took my hand, lifted it in silence to his lips.
I thank you with my whole heart. I admire you more than words can say, but I cannot take the money.
You refuse me?
Remember how poor I am. Don't ask me to say any more.
Mr. Sachs, if you won't take my gift by itself, perhaps you will take me with it.
It was leap year. I did have the right to ask first. For, of course, having refused my money, he could never have asked. As it was, we could, both of us, accept.
This story being nowadays instead of just yesterday, an abrupt Byronic hero needs not to be crippled by the malice of a mad wife before a humble little heroine can redeem him. A misunderstanding over piles and piles of money should be more than sufficient, and I'm certain it's quite as distressing. I make my will and remake it every quarter of the year. God knows how they'll muddle it after I'm dead. Who'll be the first to say that Wilkie Collins was so fuddled by his illnesses and his opium he didn't know what he was doing? His way of life so equivocal that no legal credence should be given to his relationships? I write all these stories so I don't have to think about it. And yet I must think about it, because somehow it's all got itself into the stories. I'd better begin another one, quick, before muddle and fuddle take over completely.
In Miss Morris and the Stranger by Wilkie Collins, dramatized by John Arden, Ronald Pickup was Wilkie Collins, Deborah Berlin, Nancy Morris, Alistair Danson, Sextus Sachs, Hugh Dixon, Sir Gervis Damien, Jane Whittenshaw, Mrs. Fosdyke, Alison Pettit, Miss Melbury, Lucas Rush, Freddy, Katie Lucy, Miss Ellen, and Katie Clark, Miss Eva. The pianist was Colin Guthrie. The director was David Blount.